on May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Whether we have the unique chance to visit one ourselves, or we just know them from British documentaries and period dramas, the English country house is far more than just a house. It's a world unto itself, combining architecture, evolving style and decor, and often generations of family history. And in many ways, the country house itself is a document of social change and shifts of power throughout hundreds of years of British history. Country houses evolved from fortified castles to manor houses, and then to the grand estates we began to see in the 18th and 19th centuries. Following the death of Queen Victoria in 1901, her son Prince Albert took over the crown as Edward VII and ushered in a new world which was vastly different from that of his mother's. It was the Edwardian Age. And one of the great institutions that flourished during this age was the great country house, the Edwardian country house. And as we shall see, it was a world of elegance and indeed eccentricity. I'm Carl Raymond, the host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast, where every 2 weeks we journey into corners light and dark for a look at America's Gilded Age, France's Belle Époque, and England's late Victorian and Edwardian eras. The great country houses that we see in sprawling period films and television series, including The Shooting Party, Gosford Park, and indeed even Downton Abbey, all show us multiple worlds intersecting and colliding. A country house was more than just a house. It was an entire estate, a world that beyond just upstairs and downstairs included the workers and the lives of those who kept the estate as well, from gamekeepers to gardeners. Historians have noted that the Edwardian country house represented a moment that was perhaps the pinnacle of country house life. Britain, fueled by the wealth of empire and industry, built new estates or adapted old ones from the Victorian model into mini galaxies of efficient and elegant living. Advances in technology, including vacuum cleaners and even toasters, allowed household management to run even more smoothly, as indeed some staff began to choose other forms of employment from domestic service. And of course, perhaps it was in those years of Edward's relatively short reign before the war that it was the country house weekend, with its languid hours spent at the tea table, elaborate picnics on riverbanks with china, crystal, and silver, brisk forays into the estate for some shooting, and the new cocktail hour when anything and anyone was discussed. But perhaps it was the great social game that could occur during the great country house weekend that was most important, as one navigated the chessboard for rank, recognition, or romance. To help us understand how the great Edwardian country house functioned, and to take us into that world by looking at a few great houses, is my returning guest, listener favorite, Kurt DiCamillo. Kurt joined me for one of my most popular shows last year, and that was a look at Britain's crown jewels during the coronation celebrations of King Charles III. Kurt D. Camillo is the curator of special collections at the New England Historic Genealogical Society. His career has included positions with Boston's Museum of Fine Arts and the National Trust for Scotland. He is a noted historian and a recognized authority on the British country house, about which he has written, lectured, and taught in the U.S. and abroad. Kurt is a fellow of the Royal Society of Arts and the Massachusetts Historical Society, and is a member of the Council of the American Museum in Britain. In recognition for his work, he has been presented to the late Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, and the Prince of Wales, now the present King. Kurt, it is such an honor to have you join me here on The Gilded Gentleman. I am so glad you are back across the table from me once again.
I'm tickled pink to be here. I love these conversations. They're so much fun.
I do too, and you share so much with us. And this time, we get to really delve into something that is an area of your love and expertise for sure.
Absolutely.
So, Kurt, I'd really like to begin by having you define the concept of the English country house, particularly during the 19th century, because this is not a model or something that we really had at all here in America in anything that resembled the same way. So just how did a country house work? Because it was more than a house, right?
Absolutely. The country house, by its definition and by its nature, was the center of an agricultural estate. And one of the things I'm very fond of saying, for those of you old enough to remember Gone with the Wind, is that Katie Scarlett's father said the only thing that matters is land. And that's all that there was. Because before the 18th century, there's no real stock market. So land was the only sense of real property, the only sense of money. And you did two things with land. You either farmed it, you let it out to be farmed, or you had tenants on it who paid your rent. And land was the way all throughout the world, before there was a financial system in place like we have today, that sort of indicated that you were at the top of the list. And in Britain, particularly, although this did exist in Europe, but particularly in Britain, the country house took root in a way that it did nowhere else. And has stayed with us. And the reason it stayed with us primarily is because of primogeniture, which is the eldest male inheriting everything. Which is very unfair, of course, for everybody else, including the widow and the other children. But what it does is to ensure that the entire estate passes to one person. And that is something that is enshrined in many cases in law by an act of parliament. So you have this little community, really, because that's what country houses were. They were self-sufficient communities. They had a great lord at their center, sometimes a private person who didn't have a title but had a lot of money. You had the great house. You had sometimes hundreds of houses on the estate, and oftentimes up to 1 million acres of land, sometimes encompassing 3 or 4 towns. And that's something that's very hard, I think, for Americans to understand. Even today, the great estates that are in Britain, is that the lord owns everything. So the towns that he owns the church. The church pays rent to him. And that's something that is a way of life that, strangely enough, still hangs on. But in Britain, I just can't say enough about how this wonderful enveloping sense of a family, if you had a very good lord, and they weren't all good, who treated his family well, and by his family, I mean his extended tenants. Something that is important to remember is until the 19th century, most Brits never moved more than 50 miles from the place they were born in their entire lives. So everything was focused very locally on this country house.
Now, the English country house developed over really a very long period of time. But for this show, we're really going to focus specifically on the Edwardian period. So, Kurt, can you just really define for listeners what the Edwardian period actually was?
Well, of course, technically, it's just the years of the reign of Edward VII, which was from 1901 to 1910. But as oftentimes is the case with periods in history, you have to really include things on both sides of it. So most historians believe that the Edwardian era ended with the beginning of World War I in 1914, a war that's called the Great War in the UK. And actually really began in the 1880s and 1890s under the reign of his mother, Queen Victoria.
Now, what was so different or what changed in the world of Edward VII's England. What was different from the Victorian era?
In some ways, things were very much the same. In some ways, they weren't. It's important to think, I think, of the Commonwealth when Oliver Cromwell ruled England. And when Charles II came back, there was this huge celebration of plays and debauchery. And that's very much the way Edward came to the throne in 1901, because his mother, Queen Victoria, was in mourning for 40 years. She did not like celebrations. She only allowed people in her presence to wear black and white. He loved entertaining. He loved being the center of attention. His mother hated being the center of attention. She hated being seen by the public. He took great pains to show himself to people. He loved going to the theater. He loved bright colors. He loved women. He loved food. He loved plays. He loved rich people. And this is important, too, because he had a lot of Jewish friends, something his mother, she was an anti-Semite. He embraced anybody that had money. And this is very much part of the whole Edwardian era. The term conspicuous consumption was developed specifically to describe this time period in its own time. And that's because money mattered and what you had mattered. And the more you showed it off, the more successful you were. And Edward was the epitome of that.
So do you think it's fair to say that once Edward took the throne, the party started again?
Yes. The parties were, to be fair, when he was Prince of Wales, the parties were still going on. He lived in a house in London called Marlborough House, and there was a whole contingent of people circled around him that were called the Marlborough House Set. So this was still happening, but his mother frowned on this. So when she died, she gave him, of course, as king, free rein to do all the things he'd always wanted to do much more openly and much more publicly. You had a great resurgence of building of theaters in London. Some of the greatest theaters that are in London today were built during the Edwardian era. It was just an embracing of life. And his queen, Queen Alexandra, who, of course, was the Danish princess before she married him, was beautiful. And she loved jewels. And she loved showing off. They loved going to the opera. They loved going to plays. They loved having parties at Buckingham Palace. Queen Victoria hated Buckingham Palace. She did very little there. And one of the things that I think is so interesting, dinner parties at Buckingham Palace started at 11 p.m. That's when the king and queen appeared. You arrived at 10. They arrived at 11. The whole thing would end around 2 in the morning.
You know, it's so interesting, and we don't talk enough about this on The Gilded Gentleman, but this was sort of the equivalent of the Gilded Age in Britain. They both, the Gilded Age and the Edwardian era, had different roots, and they evolved differently, but very similar, right?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, in researching my talk for today with you, I kept thinking that over and over again. This is the Gilded Age in England, and I think it's important because the difference here is Edward says it's okay. It's okay to be showy. It's okay to be luxurious. It's okay to show off in all kinds of new ways. And what feeds into that are modern department stores start coming under his reign. So the ability to sell downward to the lower classes, the middle classes, that you can be a part of this too. You can be a part of celebrity. We have the introduction in 1900 of the Brownie, the first affordable camera, which cost $1. That made photography available to everybody, no matter how wealthy or poor you were. And that meant that everybody could be a part of this huge consumer age.
Now, the 19th century in Britain really brought two factors more than that, but two we're going to talk about that really influenced country house life. And one was certainly the result of the Industrial Revolution. But then there was the age of empire. And we're going to get to technology a little bit later on. But can you talk a little bit about this age of empire and how that affected the country house specifically and how it was evolving at this point?
It's important to say, of course, that the British Empire really started in the 18th century, but I think most scholars would argue that it reached its zenith in the Edwardian era because World War I killed everything. So it reached its zenith because of a number of things, not the least of which were railroads. So this made the possibility of going to a country house weekend, which usually started on a Thursday and ended on a Monday, easy to do. Before, it would take days to get there in a coach. So you had people, it's very easy to organize long weekends. People could just come out on the train. The food was unbelievable. I mean, the servants it took to run these houses, starting in the Victorian era, but sort of reaching its height in the Edwardian era, you have these great country houses with hundreds of servants sometimes, and they were actually segmented down into all kinds of very specific specialties. So you have a still room, where alcohol is distilled. You have the ironing room where you iron your newspapers every morning for the Lord and Lady. And every single, it's astonishing the number of houses that have rooms built very specifically for functions that are necessary for the people upstairs. And this, of course, is exemplified, I think, the best in Downton Abbey. You see what it takes to have sometimes 100 servants to keep maybe 5 or 6 people upstairs in the luxury that they're accustomed to, and of course, all of their servants and their guests.
Now, one little detail that you just mentioned that I want to bring up because for 2 reasons. One is when you and I were talking about it, this was something I didn't know. And it's also the very opening moments of the very first season, of the very first episode of Downton Abbey. And that's the ironing of the newspapers. Why did they iron the newspapers?
They ironed the newspapers so that the ink wouldn't come off on the fingers of the readers.
I thought that was fascinating because I thought it was just to make them smooth and smooth out the wrinkles. But you shared with me this other reason, which I thought was very interesting.
That heat sort of binds the ink to the paper. And the important thing, really think about, because when researching this today, I read a number of books on the Edwardian era. And the one thing that comes out over and over again is that country house weekends were about food above all else. The food was astonishing.
And we'll talk about that because that was another show of wealth. That was another show of excellence. It was also something to do is to sit around the dinner table or whatever it happened to be. So I'd like to talk for a moment about the country house itself. Now, many of these great country houses evolved from earlier manor houses, and some were actually built new during the period. So, Kurt, from an architectural and design standpoint, is there something we can pinpoint that defines an English country house from a look?
Country houses really began under the reign of Elizabeth I, and they reached their zenith under the reign of Edward VII. But there are very few examples of houses that were built specifically from the ground up during Edward's reign. Most country houses, the more you research them, they're just an accumulation of style. So the house could have been started in 1580, and then 18th century a new wing was added, and the 19th century another wing was added. In the 20th century, they took part of it down. So very few houses really began under Edward's reign. But the houses that were the peak of society, the houses that the king himself visited, were houses that were much older, that had had Edwardian additions, because I just described to you all these specialized rooms that were needed for Victorian and Edwardian houses for the servants. And those didn't exist in earlier houses, so you had to have huge additions in the 19th century to accommodate all of this. There were houses that were designed in the Edwardian age, and I would say the ones that are most noteworthy are those designed by Edwin Lutyens, who is considered one of the greatest British architects of all time.
Can you give us a few examples of those?
I can. There's a wonderful house in Kent with the strange name, The Salutation, that is privately owned. There's a house you can visit that he designed in East Lothian in Scotland called Grey Walls, which is really famous because it's a golf resort now. It has been a golf resort actually for some time. I have to say, to me, the house that really epitomized this whole era is a house called Clouds, not designed by Lutyens, designed by an architect called Philip Webb, built for the very wealthy Wyndham family in Wiltshire. And it had a very short shelf life. By the 1930s, the family had left, and it has been one sort of institution ever since. It's now a home for recovering drug addicts. And it was the house where the Souls met, one of the preeminent groups of Edwardian England. The Souls were this group of very rich intellectuals who talked about deep subjects in literature and art. And Clouds was sort of the epitome of that. And it's oftentimes used as an example today of the Edwardian era because the house itself had such a short shelf life. Because very unusual for British houses to be in and out in like 40 years.
Are there any particular design features that you can point that tie all these houses together so we would look at it and say, wow, that's an Edwardian house?
Yes, and the answer is what I would call very, very broadly the arts and crafts movement. So most of these houses were designed in the arts and crafts style. And there's actually a house that doesn't exist anymore called Borough Court in Leicestershire that was built in 1905. Amazing because in 1930, it was the place where Wallace Simpson met the Prince of Wales for the first time. And it's interesting because it doesn't have the same feeling as what you would think of as a country house. It was designed by an architect called Walter Brierley, who was considered a master of the arts and crafts style. And it burned in 1944, and it doesn't exist anymore. But it's, if you see that style of house, very arts and crafts, which is, say, a lot of rooms, but not really big rooms, not high ceilings, much more intimate. That, to me, is the style of the Edwardian country house, which is very different than the Edwardian style of Edward himself, who liked very big rooms with lots of gold and white.
And with that, Kurt and I are going to take a short break, but we'll be back to continue the story.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast, and today I'm talking with historian and authority on the English country house, Kurt DiCamillo. Now, I chose to title this episode, The Edwardian Country House, Elegance and Eccentricity. So, Kurt, how do you feel that that applies to the style of the Edwardians? Was there really a hint or maybe more of eccentricity in all of this?
There was certainly elegance. I have to say, anything involving Britain is eccentric by nature. I don't know if there's anything more particularly eccentric about the Edwardian country house, except for one thing that comes to mind, which is the ability of the Edwardian hostess to understand who was attracted to whom and how to place their bedrooms next to each other. They were surprisingly progressive and liberal in this sense. So if two men were having an affair, a good hostess would know to put them in adjoining bedrooms, even though they were married. Same thing with men and women, even two women having affairs. The idea was make everybody happy. Make everybody enjoy themselves. Give them free rein, because it wasn't just about the food. It was also about the company. And beyond the fact that you ate a lot, you went shooting, you took long walks, you go to follies and have lunches and teas, they really didn't do very much except change clothes repeatedly throughout the day.
I think this sounds like my idea of heaven. And I think you'd probably agree with that too.
If I was at the top of the heap, yes.
So, Kurt, you just mentioned the kind of emergence of the great country house weekend, and I'd love you to talk a little bit more about this, because this really did seem to come into being in the Edwardian period. The idea of an actual weekend was kind of new. All of us remember that famous, you know, Maggie Smith line, "What is a weekend?" But just how did a country house weekend function at its height?
it functioned as a place of pleasure. Now, once again, we're only talking about very rich people who were invited down to these great houses. And the hostess of the house, her whole life was focused on entertaining, and her whole judgment by society was how well she entertained. If you had the king to stay or the queen, obviously you were at the top of the heap. How many shooting parties? How many servants? How many people that could provide exotic dishes when you had someone foreign coming to stay and they would ask for something that the Brits hadn't heard of? You remember actually in Gosford Park when the American Hollywood producer was a vegetarian and the cook didn't know what that meant. So it meant anticipating things. And most particularly because Edward was a Francophile, he loved everything French, and supposedly he loved going incognito to Paris and just enjoying life. And French cooking, having a French chef, was the very height of fashion. They were the most expensive things. And if you read in Jeeves and Wooster, the great books by P.G. Wodehouse, you see of all people, French chefs were valued above everything. And I'm making this up because I can't remember the numbers, but you would pay a French chef about £200 a year in the Edwardian era, whereas a footman would get £10 a year. So what that was, what all of Edwardian society is about, was bragging. You gave you bragging rights. You had a French chef. The king loved sophisticated food. The king loved multi-course lunches and dinners. And what you had, if you had the very, very top of society, you had to have an enormous amount of money to have all these servants. And the reason it worked is because there were so many people who were not employed in other ways, because Britain was still sort of coming out of the age of agriculture and coming into the industrial world. You had an awful lot of people who were very happy to work in a country house where they got half a day off a week, but they were close to their parents and they didn't have to go to big cities. And there was beginning in the Edwardian era, primarily because of the success of the Industrial Revolution, looking back to this fond, imaginary, idyllic, rural past in Britain. That's where we have the beginning, something we still have today, which is the idea of this happy, perfect Britain where everyone smiles and has plowman lunches and people out in the fields. Of course, that world never existed, but it makes us feel good. And the Edwardians were the ones who invented that because of the harshness, because of the ugliness of industrialization.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, technology was a big part of all of this, allowing these great houses to function. So can you share a little bit about what some of the new technology was and how it helped the world of the country house function? And I'm thinking probably predominantly below stairs here.
I would say exclusively below stairs. And once again, you can go back to Downton Abbey. I can't remember what it was. There was something Mrs. Patmore, the cook, didn't
want.
Was
it a toaster or something?
It was something.
I don't remember.
It was some newfangled thing. It's like, no, I don't want to do that. This is the beginning of technology. And the reason today, interestingly enough, let's use gardeners as an example. The reason you can have an estate today with 5 gardeners that had 60 gardeners in the Edwardian age is because of technology, because of lawnmowers, because of all kinds of mechanized equipment. The same thing was true inside the house. Let's say there was an early 20th century ad in Selfridges that showed a housemaid vacuuming in front of a footman, and he was just astonished at how this thing sucked dirt out of the carpet. And it's important to remember, before then, carpets were rolled up, taken outside on a line, and beaten to get the dirt out of them. So just think of that. We're talking a full day process to clean a carpet, and now you can just run a machine over it. What this did, of course, was ultimately make the numbers of servants less needed.
Which had an enormous impact on the country house, which we're going to get to a little bit later. Am I right about that?
Absolutely.
So, Kurt, for this section, I'd really like to talk about several specific houses. You've mentioned a few, but I want to talk about some others and what life was like in each one and why they were important in the Edwardian era. So let's start with Sandringham in Norfolk, which may be actually familiar to some listeners. It's currently a royal residence. This was the famous estate and home where the royal family has traditionally spent Christmas. But it's a grand estate. It was actually built for Bertie himself. Can you talk a little bit about Sandringham, what this look and feel is like. And you also, when we were chatting a couple of weeks ago, you said this was the quintessential Edwardian house in taste and style. What did you mean by all that?
I mean that when you go to Sandringham, which to me is the most personal and most intimate of all the royal residences, and if I was forced to live in a royal residence, it would be this house that I would choose. It's big, but it's not huge. It's filled with clutter. And what's amazing about it is that it has never really changed. It might change under the current reign, but you have a succession of women, starting with Queen Alexandra, who maintained this house as a great eclectic knick-knack house with cabinets of just things that you would say, oh, there's grandma's porcelain collection. And in fact, instead of porcelain, it would be Fabergé. But it's very cozy, it's very middle class, and it's important to remember that the British royal family have never been noted for their exquisite taste. I would say Charles, the current king, being the exception. I have a friend, a British architectural historian, who in describing Sandringham said, it's really a perfect example of the royal family not having good taste. Now, that's very harsh. I think most historians would agree with that. And the proof of that is when the Queen was buying Sandringham for her son, the then Prince of Wales, they looked at Houghton Hall, which is nearby, which is considered one of the finest Palladian houses in the world. And it was dismissed because it wasn't the right taste. And the house that was at Sandringham, this is the third house that's on that site that's there now. It was demolished, and in 1870, it was rebuilt for Albert in what has to be really described as a Victorian Edwardian style, which is red brick. It's asymmetrical. It's only two rooms deep. It has a long facade, but it's not very deep beyond those walls. It's got a lot of smaller rooms, and every room is cluttered. And after Queen Victoria, you have Queen Mary, the wife of Edward V, who maintained it as it was. And then you had Edward VI's wife, Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother. She maintained it the same. And then Queen Elizabeth, the late Queen Elizabeth, once again, she maintained it that way. And this unbroken style of Edwardian living, I think, is almost unique. And I suspect the reason that the late Queen Elizabeth kept it the way it was is because it was a house that she grew up in. And she remembered it with fondness. And it's the house, I think, that best exemplifies the royal family as real people. When you go to see it, it's just very intimate. It's wonderfully put together. It's not an impressive house in the least, but it's so homey. It's so wonderful.
And all of that supports this tradition, right, of the royal family spending Christmas together, because what else would you want except a homey, cozy place to spend Christmas, right?
Yes, and I think they also spend possibly the month of August. I think they spend one other time there a year. But yes, it's a place that's just so intimate. There's, on the drive up to the house, there are three little gravestones, I remember, all dogs of the late Queen Elizabeth. So that's very personal. That's very real. And it makes you realize that the royal family are real people.
Now, I'd like to move on to Elvedon Hall in Suffolk. Now, this was a house that I didn't know at all. You introduced it to me in our conversations leading up to the show. But it seems that that really also truly represents Edwardian influence, particularly of empire and the quintessential country house activity of the shooting party. So can you talk a little bit about Elvedon Hall and this idea of the shoots and the hunts and all the rest of that?
So Elvedon Hall is a very interesting situation. It was given to Prince Victor Duleep Singh, who was the last ruler of the Punjab, which, of course, the British stole from him. And he was sort of given this as a consolation prize. It was a very big estate. There was an earlier house there that he rebuilt in the 1860s, very much in the Victorian style. And he made it a great destination for shooting. It has a 17,000-acre estate. He eventually turned against the British as he grew, and he got to realize that he'd been disinherited and things had been stolen from him, not just his land. He also had the largest diamond in the world, the Koh-i-Noor, which was taken by the British and is now in the crown jewels. And then it was bought in the Edwardian era by Edward Guinness of the famous Guinness fortune. And he's the one who really made it the Edwardian house to be. He took it and enormously enlarged it, and in sort of a bow of acknowledgement to Duleep Singh, he put this great Indian hall inside this house. So you have this house that's enormous on the outside. It's 25 bays long, has a great dome in the center. Looks very Baroque. When you go inside, there are a series of three staterooms, for lack of better words, that are taken out of the Indian subcontinent. Two of them were put in by Duleep Singh, and the grandest one was put in by Lord Iva. So Lord Iva is the title, Earl of Iva, that was given to Edward Guinness, basically because he was so rich. And he held these great hunting parties there. Duleep Singh had done this as well, but Lord Iva took it to a new level. In the Victorian and Edwardian world, shooting was the center of country house life. Sandringham, under Edward VII, was the finest place in the country to shoot. The second finest was Elveden. And that's because Lord Iva was so rich. And because what he wanted, like all rich country house owners, was to attract the king to shoot. So what you did was you beefed up the estate. You had lots of gamekeepers. You had lots of beaters, men who beat the bushes to make the birds fly so you could shoot them. And there were astonishing and actually grotesque numbers of birds that were shot, sometimes, you know, 1,000 in a day. But this was considered great sport, and it was considered the height of refinement in country sports. And that's something that's really important. Country house, obviously, by its definition, is in the country. And something else we have that really popularized the whole idea of country house movement and life was the founding in 1897 of Country Life magazine, which to this day is sort of the Bible for country house living, and reached its height in the Edwardian era because of cheap photography, because of cheap paper, mass production of magazines and newspapers. You had the whole idea of country life living that had been very much contained to a very small elite group being spread to the general populace. Everybody knew about these hunts. Everybody knew where the king was, where he spent the weekend, how many partridges he shot. All printed in the newspapers together with photographs, particularly in country life. So you had aspirational living. You had people saying, I want to be invited to these. And then you also had, it's important to remember, the Industrial Revolution brings about the decline of the aristocracy. So the aristocracy is waning in the Edwardian era. Men of wealth, men of money, men of the city, which would be the Wall Street in London, bankers, what they called the landlords, the great gold barons in South Africa, all of them come to London, have houses in London, and they have to have a country house. So the biggest, richest people are the nouveau riche, the people who have new money, because we have the decline of the aristocracy, we also have the decline of agriculture. Because of cheap American grain exports, the value of land is falling in Britain. And when you have falling land prices, and the only thing you own as an aristocrat is land, people don't want your land. It doesn't have value anymore. You have people who are bankers and the Erevistes who are coming in. They can afford to entertain the king in a way you can't. So you have a very big transition phase going on. It's not just the long Edwardian afternoon, we're oftentimes told, where there's this great sense of peace and stability. There are huge changes going on beneath the surface. And you have one class going out, the aristocracy, and the new rich coming in.
And with that, Kurt and I are going to take a short break, but we'll be back to continue the story.
I won't let my active psoriatic arthritis joint symptoms define me.
Emerge as you. Tremfya guselkumab is proven to significantly reduce joint pain, stiffness, and swelling in adults with active psoriatic arthritis. Some patients even reported less fatigue as assessed by survey 1 week prior. Results may vary. Tremfya is taken by injection 6 times a year after 2 starter doses at week 0 and 4.
Serious allergic reactions may occur. Tremfya may increase your risk of infections and lower your ability to fight them. Before treatment, your doctor should check you for infections and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms of infection, including fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough. Tell your doctor if you had a vaccine or plan to.
Emerge as you. Learn more about Tremfya, including important safety information, at Tremfya.com or call 1-877-578-3527. See our ad in Food & Wine magazine. For patients prescribed Tremfya, cost support may be available.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And we're back. I'm Carl Raymond, host of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. And today I'm talking with historian and authority on the English country house, Kerr DiCamillo. Now, before we go on to our next couple of houses, I want to really address the downstairs staff here, because it's great if we all get to go and have wonderful shooting parties and elegant dinners, but someone has to all make that happen, right? And that was the extraordinary domestic staffs that worked in these houses. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it sounds, and we saw a lot of this, of course, in dramas like Downton Abbey. There was an advantage to this kind of life. This was safe. This was secure. You mentioned you could be near your family. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the pros and cons of that world?
Everything depended on your lord and master and how he treated the staff. Let's use Downton Abbey as an example, which is an extreme, probably non-realist example of a very enlightened ownership. But examples like that did exist where people felt proud to be in service, and that's what it was called to work at a country house. At any level, you were in service. They were proud because their father had done it, their grandfather, their great-grandfather. They were proud to serve a family, and if they had a good lord, they were taken care of. They had housing for free. Their food was free. They didn't get paid much, but this was a very small world, and they felt safe, just as you suggested, a cocoon with people that they had grown up with, and their grandfathers had been friends with each other. Everybody knew everybody else. There's a sense of contentment. This starts to get uprooted in the Edwardian era because of modern technology, because of armaments manufacturing, because of the Industrial Revolution. But it still hangs on as something to be emulated. And it's not until World War I that we really have the breaking of that mold.
So now let's go on to another house, Goodwood House. This is in West Sussex. It was another on the list that you gave and we talked about. So this was a house that was built in the 17th century, and this evolved, and this became another important center in the Edwardian period. What should we know about Goodwood?
Well, Goodwood, as you said, is a perfect example of a house that has many layers. So with a 17th century core and then 18th and 19th century additions, by the Edwardian era, it was one of the houses to be entertained in. And Edward VII made a number of visits there. The reason is because he, like most of his predecessors and successors, loved horse racing. And there had been horse racing at Goodwood since the 18th century. But in the early 19th century, a famous race that still exists today called Glorious Goodwood started. And Glorious Goodwood, as today, as in the Edwardian age, was a place to be seen in society. If you liked horse racing, you wanted to dress up in your finest clothes, you wanted to be seen where all the greats and goods of society came together. And the king, as I said before, loved being seen. He loved waving to the crowds. He loved being the public eye. He loved horse racing. He had a lot of racehorses. And he also, of course, loved women. And one of the things that happened with hostesses, and this is certainly true at Goodwood House, is that when you invited the king and queen to stay, you made sure you invited the king's current mistress, and you put her in a room very convenient to him.
Now, I want to end with another house that when you gave me your list of houses you'd like to discuss, I was surprised that it was on the list because, and it's Warwick Castle. And I thought this was such a curious choice because that's actually a medieval castle. But then when you and I chatted about it, you shared really a fascinating story of how that became an important house, with a little bit of an eccentric story here, during the Edwardian period. So how does Warwick fit into all this?
Well, Warwick is considered the finest medieval castle in England. It's enormous. It's been owned by the Earls of Warwick. It was owned by them until 1978. It's now owned by Madame Tussauds. It's a very big tourist attraction. But in the Edwardian era, it was presided over by Daisy, Countess of Warwick, who was very unusual. She came from a very privileged background, as you would expect, but became a socialist, and she was known as the Red Countess. She believed in housing for the poor. She believed in old age pensions. She thought women should be educated, and she gave enormous amounts of money of her own to accomplish these purposes. She was also a mistress of Edward VII, and even more importantly, his confidant. He actually believed in her opinions as being valid and worth taking in, which was interesting because she had a nickname that would belie that. Before her husband inherited the earldom, he was Lord Brooke. And she was called Babbling Brooke because she couldn't keep her mouth shut. She was a great gossip, but she had enormous parties at Warwick Castle. Everybody who was anybody was invited to Warwick at the time. This is important to get back to the media again. Publications like Country Life that had photographs of great parties, weekend parties at Warwick Castle with all these titled peers. And as I say before, this encouraged the middle classes to say, I want to be a part of this. And for the first time, you really have a media promoting a lifestyle, the English country house lifestyle.
So after Edward's death, and you've stated this, the Edwardian era continued on for a while, yet the country house and country house life really began to disappear. What happened? Where did it go?
Well, World War I changed everything. I mean, enormously. I would say, as a historian, we are still living with the effects of World War I today. It took the Victorian Edwardian sense of limitless accomplishment, that man could do anything, that engineering could overcome anything, that medicine could overcome diseases. That was all completely wiped away by the carnage of World War I, which was made possible, interestingly enough, by mechanization. So nobody was prepared for what happened. They all knew war was coming, and that's very much seen in one of the movies that I love, The Shooting Party. They believe a war is essential. They believe it's cathartic. It will clear out the decadence. And that's something else that's important to remember, too. Even in its own time frame, the Edwardian era was declared decadent, that it was all focused on money and show. And you had this sense that after this war, which will last 2 or 3 months, of course, it lasted 4 years, will be better. Nobody, and I mean nobody, saw what was coming, which was to undermine the very confidence of Western European civilization, something I don't think we've ever recovered, and taking away confidence in government, in leadership, in the aristocracy, and the ability to kill people on such a mass scale without any kind of feeling. And it's something that I can't even take in myself sometimes because it's so enormous, what's given us today as an inheritance. The Edwardian era was really the last blooming of European civilization.
So, Kurt, if you could transport yourself back in time to the Edwardian era, these Edwardian years, which house or which estate would you choose for your very own? Where would you live?
Well, I've chosen a house, you very kindly gave me a heads up on this, called Kendal Park in Denbighshire in Wales, which is now semi-ruinous, which was sort of, in my mind, the epitome of the Edwardian country house. It was called the Welsh Versailles. It was called a combination between what you saw at Hampton Court, the part designed by Christopher Wren, and a great chateau in Normandy called Chateau de Valois. This gargantuan house that had almost 500 rooms, that had a relatively short shelf life. In 1977, there was a great fire. Part of it was abandoned, and then it became all kinds of institutional uses, and finally in 1998, it just became unoccupied. And interestingly enough, I was researching this morning. It just sold in 2021, much to my surprise, to a local Welsh couple for £850,000. Now, that's not a lot of money for a house that big, especially in New York, but they estimate it will take £20 million to restore it. And you can go and Google it. It's K-I-N as in Nancy, M as in Michael, E-L. And it is the epitome in my mind of an Edwardian country house. And I would have loved to have lived there in that time period.
Oh, Kurt, once again, you have given us some really fascinating new perspective on all of this, and certainly a new way to look at the world of the country house in general, and certainly the Edwardian country house. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure to be here.
Well, as we said last time, there is so much more to say and cover. So, Kurt, will you come back and join me again? I'm sure we could find something to talk about. Thank you, Kurt, so, so much.
Thank you.
I know listeners will want to follow all of your talks and lectures, as well as your tours to the UK and Europe. My listeners, you can sign up for Kurt's newsletter at thedcamillo.com, and that will be on my website as well, so you can find it there. And as you saw today, Kurt's expertise on the English country house is truly extensive, and he has amassed a really extraordinary database of country houses and estates that you can browse for some really fascinating information. And to my listeners, thank you for joining me for another episode of the Gilded Gentleman History Podcast. The Gilded Gentleman is produced by Bowery Boys Media, and this episode was edited and produced by Kieran Gannon. I invite listeners to become patrons of the show on patreon.com/thegildedgentleman. Your support helps me in a very direct way to manage the costs of production, research, studio rentals, and allows me to continue to write and create the show. I couldn't do it without you. Thank you. If you aren't already receiving my monthly newsletter with updates on my events, tours, and podcast previews, you can sign up on my website, thegildedgentleman.com. And I'll see you soon. What's life without a little glint of gold?
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.